From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. On the show today, the intersection between homelessness and AIDS is the focus of a new study by two Milwaukee researchers. Then instrumental tunes tend to get a lot of the attention in traditional Celtic music, but the newly formed trio The Alt has a different focus.
We just felt that songs were being left behind just a little bit, you know, and not as many young people are taking it up. So we just decided when we're here and alive on this earth to kind of keep on going and kind of bringing forth these songs as much as we can.
And as a celebration of the Cornish people in Wisconsin takes place this week, a native son wishes his homeland would do better.
They really haven't used the opportunity to delve into their history, to really establish themselves as a nation. And they've missed out on these Cornish communities around the world, which are still extremely active and still have the feeling of being Cornish.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect for Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in this morning. Earlier this week, we heard about the effectiveness of one Milwaukee-based organization in helping the quality of life for AIDS patients. The strength of the work of the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin lies in its so-called medical home model, in which a variety of services, from medical care to pharmacy to mental health support, are provided under one roof. But reaching and helping people with HIV and AIDS can be especially challenging when we're talking about the homeless population. In recent years, a variety of supporting housing programs have evolved in an effort to help homeless people live longer, healthier lives with HIV. But little is known about how well those programs work. Two Milwaukee researchers are hoping to find the answers. Julia Dixon Gomez and Stephen Pinkerton are scientists with the Center for AIDS Intervention Research and are recipients of a multimillion-dollar federal grant to study housing, homelessness, and AIDS. The two joined Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke in the studio, and Dickinson Gomez explained what we already know about the link between homelessness and AIDS.
One thing we know is that the homeless are about 16 times more likely to become infected with HIV than people who are not homeless. We also know that among people who are already infected with HIV, about half of them have reported housing needs. We know that those who are homeless have a harder time getting access and linked into medical care. They have a poorer adherence to antiretroviral medicines, which help them live longer.
And is part of that because of their housing situation?
Most definitely. I mean, it's hard to keep track of pills when you're moving from place to place. It's harder. Just the general life is a little bit chaotic. Also, I think sometimes there's still stigma and a lot of people want to hide taking medication. That's harder to do if you're in a shelter or if you're kind of temporarily doubling up with another drug-using acquaintance, for example.
And you mentioned drug use, and the homeless population isn't just impacted with HIV, but there are other issues that are wrapped up with this too, right?
Yeah. I mean, the study that was just funded, which is actually my third study on housing / homelessness and HIV, this is a project that's going to be looking at supportive housing programs, which are designed for a particular segment of the homeless population, what is generally considered the chronically homeless. In order to be eligible for the subsidies for supportive housing programs, generally people receive shelter plus care subsidies, which means you have one of three qualifying conditions. So you're HIV positive, you have substance use disorder or severe mental illness. Oftentimes they have a couple or all three. The chronically homeless is actually defined as people who have been homeless for a period longer than a year or for people who've had multiple periods of homelessness in the last 3 years. So these are kind of, for want of a better word, kind of the more severe end of the spectrum of homelessness.
And maybe this is an obvious question, but what are the challenges in studying these issues and this population? This is not always an easy population to quantify, right?
not so much if they're housed, and that's hopefully going to be the case in this study. In the previous two studies, we were actually looking at people in a variety of housing situations, but all low income. And yes, the homeless are hard to track. They have often transient work, so they'll be gone for a season. They often end up in jail, unfortunately, or the hospital. So we don't have – we have pretty good retention rates. But the previous studies were in Hartford, Connecticut as well, which is a small city. So we knew where to look for them, and if we couldn't find them, we generally figured they weren't there and that they would eventually show up. So sometimes we had longitudinal studies where we would track them at 6 and 12 months. Sometimes when we couldn't find them at 6 months, we could at 12. So,
Stephen Pinkerton, why is this work the purview of psychiatry and behavioral medicine?
Well, I think the link there are two pieces to it that go together. One is related to the fact that HIV does have effects on the brain. So very early on, that was one link between the study of HIV and mental health, in particular, the National Institute of Mental Health at NIH began to fund these studies. The other obvious link is that HIV is behaviorally transmitted, and even now, as we have more effective treatments, behavior plays an important role in making sure people actually take those treatments, attend their medical appointments, et cetera. So HIV is very much a behavioral disease that also has important neurological impacts.
What are the different kinds of housing models that you're studying? Because that's I guess, the key question you're asking in this latest work is the effectiveness of these various models. What are the types of models that exist?
Most of this comes under the umbrella of supportive housing, and a lot of it was modeled from a program in New York called Pathways to Housing. Now, this was a different kind of model. This kind of model they call housing first. So the idea is that whatever their problems are in terms of mental illness or substance use, it's important first to get them housed before they can try to address these other issues. Prior to that, they had kind of continuum of care models where people had to go through drug treatment or mental health treatment, maybe spend some time in halfway houses and go through all these hoops before they were eligible for permanent housing. So supportive housing is permanent supportive housing. And so the Pathways model was definitely a harm reduction approach. Come as you are. You have the right to accept any kind of services. These programs are usually linked with services, at a minimum, case management to help with daily living.
And these are typically under the same roof?
No, not necessarily. They have both project-based and scattered sites. So project-based is under one roof. Scattered site, you get a housing voucher, much like a housing choice voucher, which used to be known as Section 8, and you get to choose your own apartment. So it's kind of the idea like free market rental housing, except that people in the agency often intervene and have close relationships with landlords to make it easier for people to rent because they don't have the best credit histories. They often have incarceration histories. So, I mean, that's one of the differences in the models. I think originally the Pathways to Housing model was very much consumer choice. So the idea was that people would get vouchers and have a choice in where to live. In practice, it doesn't always happen like that. Sometimes it's an active choice. You know, it's much easier to provide services under one roof. All the services that residents might need. On the other hand, you know, they lose a sense of autonomy and choice. On the other hand, in practice, sometimes because demand's so outmatches – or the need so outmatches the actual supply of supportive housing. In reality, people may not have that much choice at all. I think what may happen in practice is that people are on a waiting list and then they take what they can get, which may or may not be the best match. And, of course, there are all sorts of other issues that probably play into the decision about where and what kind of housing to provide. There are, you know, the reactions from neighbors. There are funding constraints. And so I think this is the first study, to my knowledge, where we can really look at a place that has a significant number of supportive housing units because Chicago and Illinois in general, but particularly Chicago, has been one of the forerunners in the supportive housing movement, and take a look at how all these different factors affect the kinds of housing that are provided.
Does that mean that the current approach to housing as a factor in preventing and treating HIV has largely been guided through theory or hunches to this point?
More or less. I mean, there have been there has been studies that have shown a definite link between improvements in housing status and improvements in health and decreases in emergency room visits for those living with HIV, and decreases in sexual and drug injection risks for those who are not yet positive. But Chicago was actually one of the first sites where they did a randomized control trial. They had people who were homeless, and they randomized them to immediate supportive housing or waitlist control. And in their intent to treat analysis, you know, just comparing those in the two conditions, regardless of what their housing status became, they found some not significant findings, but definite trends. But what had happened actually is that half of the people in the waitlist control achieved housing because they were getting all sorts of caseworker help in obtaining housing. So when you look at actually the people who were not getting housing and those who were, and did that comparison, there were definite significant differences in terms of health outcomes and risk behavior. And I think we're pretty convinced that, yes, housing works. The question, though, is which model of housing works the best and for what kind of resident, and how much do they cost, which is where Steve comes in.
We're interested not only in the benefits that can be achieved, but at what cost. Obviously, these programs are not free. However, in addition to providing housing to people who otherwise would be unstably housed, they also have a lot of societal benefits. Julia already mentioned the fact that we'd expect to see fewer hospitalizations, fewer emergency room visits, hopefully less incarceration. There are a number of societal benefits that we'd like to capture the cost of to see, in fact, whether these programs pay for themselves. And maybe more importantly and more in line with the rest of the project, we'd like to look at what factors drive that. Is it a particular model of supportive housing? Is it whether or not things are clustered versus scattered site? What are those factors that affect the cost? And overall, is the cost beneficial? Does it actually pay for itself? Is it cost saving?
And presumably, this is the kind of data that housing agencies or public health units of government or policymakers can take when they're actually trying to shape what housing for this population should look like in a particular community.
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, this National AIDS Housing Coalition and the research summit that they do, they have been very interested in cost-benefit analyses and cost-effectiveness, and there have been a number of studies that have done that have shown that, yes, housing is cost-effective, but this question of which model is, again, kind of up in the air.
Well, but presumably maybe at the end of this five-year period, a little less up in the air.
We hope to tease it apart, but
we
it is very complicated. You've got personal, individual factors. You've got factors at the housing level. There are a number of variables to take into account.
We'll learn. I'm confident we'll learn some things.
Yes.
Well, hopefully in the years down the road, we can have you back and talk about what you're learning.
Sure.
Be
my pleasure.
Julia Dixon Gomez and Stephen Pinkerton, thank you so much to both of you, and best of luck with your work.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Julia Dixon Gomez and Steve Pinkerton are professors of psychiatry and behavioral medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin and are researchers with the Center for AIDS Intervention Research. They are recipients of a five-year, $3.1 million grant from the National Institutes of Health to study housing models for homeless people with AIDS. They spoke with Mitch Teich. The city of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, bills itself as the city of five seasons. What the fifth is, we can only imagine. But Lake Effect essayist Joel Habish would make the case that Milwaukee is truly a city of five seasons: spring, summer, fall, winter, and festival season.
As a public service, I'm providing you with your guide to festing. Festivals are so ubiquitous and top of the mind around here that fest, like party, has become a verb. Milwaukee is known as the city of festivals. Actually, Milwaukee is an old Indian word meaning that big place, you know, east of Waukesha, down by the lake. Anyway, there certainly are festivals galore around here. Some are ethnic, some are cause-driven, some just pure, some impure, music. If you've never gone to a festival here, wow, you must have been recently unfrozen. Of course, Milwaukee in winter is cryogenic heaven. I'll give you a quick heads up on them. The two biggies are Summerfest, the world's largest music festival, and the Wisconsin State Fair, which is so attractive, more people from Chicago's northern suburbs and Lake County go here rather than to the Illinois State Fair. Now, they both feature headliners on the main stage, and they provide work for talented local musicians on stages throughout the venues. Next come the ethnic festivals. One word, bratwurst. You want another word? Cheese. It doesn't matter what your ethnic background is, what church you go to. Bokeh, or mosque, temple, or hill you stand on with aluminum foil on your head waiting for the spaceship, there will be bratwurst. Of course, we all remember the disastrous summer of 05 when Scandinavian Fest served up bratwurst made from lutefisk. I can still taste it. So prepare for a whole lot of eating. Don't starve yourself beforehand. You don't want to show up with a shrunk stomach. And due to some antiquated health laws, they don't have permission for vomitoriums on the grounds. One more bit of advice on the food. Try something new. It's all part of the festival experience. Every year, fests become feasts, and they vie with one another for the most brilliant new taste sensation, State Fair being the champion in this area. It's usually a combination of what would seem to be incongruous ingredients, often on a stick. And why not? In the Navy, I was served plenty of food on a shingle. So limber up your taste buds, get into the spirit of things, and dive into those liver sausage cookies. Try a herring eclair, and you simply can't pass up the pizza made with cookie dough. Oh yeah, and pulled pork popsicles, and in the festival spirit of piling on, with bits of bacon. If you're planning to attend any festival in Milwaukee, remember this caveat: dress appropriately. And that does not mean wearing reindeer antlers if you're going to Lapland Fest. By the way, its musical entertainment does not feature lap dances. But aside from Milwaukee's tropical weather, usually August 5th to August 6th, conditions can get dicey. Always pack a rain poncho, and any time after September 30th, include gloves and earmuffs. I'm just saying. Now, if you're going to an event that is celebrating a particular lifestyle, political position, meeting a nonprofit's goal, or a mode or brand of transportation, and you're not really that interested in it, remember there's one thing that will bring everyone together. That's right, bratwurst. One wonderful thing about the festivals that each year brings something new. Next year will bring an island celebration. To precede the word fest and to encompass both Micronesia and Polynesia, I suggested Milk of Magnesia, but I was told that it would only appeal to folks my age. So it will be Oceana Fest. One of their charming customs was sacrificing virgins to appease the volcanic gods. But they will not be doing that here because of a problem they share with many service organizations: lack of volunteers. In conclusion, please bear in mind that at the end of the day, first time ever that phrase was used appropriately, while the fest had featured traffic log jams, far distant parking, long lines, people standing on picnic tables so you couldn't see the band, seared bodies that could have used more clothing, if only for aesthetic reasons, beer slushing, and plenty of sweat, there is an upside. You only have to wait a week before the next one.
Lake Effect essayist Joel Habish is a freelance copywriter who lives in West Allis. He's past president of Working Writers of Wisconsin and worked for years at ad agencies in Milwaukee and Chicago. Well, we'll have some music from one of those festivals coming up next when the Irish trio The Alt joins us in Lake Effect's performance studio. You are listening to us on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
Soldier Jenny, I'm off for the rolling sea. They've given me a golden guinea, which they say has enlisted me. And I'm off to fight for the army as a Lancashire Fusilier. Rolling my musket in my arm.
It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Irish Fest starts tonight, and for the next 3.5 days, Irish, Scottish, Canadian, American, and Iberian music will ring out on the stages at the Henry Meyer Festival Park. Every year, Irish Fest has a musical focus, and this year, the year of the just-completed, wildly successful Commonwealth Games in Glasgow and the upcoming vote for independence on the 18th of September, it's Scotland. Over the next couple of days, we'll feature some Scottish performers in the studio, but this morning we'll start with a band whose members are all from Ireland, although none of them call it home now. The Alt is a new trio of three of the finest musicians working in the tradition today: flutist and singer Nuala Kennedy, guitarist and singer John Doyle, and multi-instrumentalist and singer Eamon O'Leary. Here they are with their arrangement of Going for a Soldier.
Long and dearly I have loved you, you must full well have known. If I never had faith disproved you, then I might.
The Alt in Lake Effect's performance studio, Going for a Soldier, John Doyle, Nuala Kennedy, and Eamon O'Leary. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you very much.
It's fantastic, and what a great tune to start us off with. Let's start with how you guys got together, because you all have solo careers and you've played with loads of other folks. When did the Alt come about, and why? Why did you decide that you wanted to do this trio?
Well, we all started to talk about it a couple of years ago, and the idea of creating a band of singers, because we felt kind of that the songs themselves were being left behind a little bit compared to the tunes. And we all love songs, traditional songs, quite a lot, you know, and we've spent our lives learning them. And so we figured to get together, and we were old friends, you know. I've known Eamon for 20-something years now, and Nuala for 10 or more even. And yeah. So we decided just to kind of get together and be pals and hang around and sing songs. And so that's how it started. And then it took another couple of years to actually do it. And so we finally got it together and got an album just getting to going, right?
Yeah, we're hoping it's going to arrive on Friday or Saturday.
Oh, so brand new.
Yeah.
Yeah, brand spanking new.
I love the idea that you're focusing on the actual songs. They're such great, great songs in the traditions of both Ireland and Scotland.
There's an awful lot of life lessons in these songs, and, you know, and tunes are great, and we all love those too, you know, we spent many years doing that as well. But we just felt that songs were being left behind just a little bit, you know, and not as many young people are taking it up, so we just decided, like, we'd figure out when we're here and alive on this earth to kind of keep on going and kind of bringing forth these songs as much as we can, you know.
Well, Nuala, you sing on your other albums, you know, there's always been vocal in what you do, in addition to the flute and the whistle.
Yeah, I kind of started singing pretty early on, and then playing as well. So yeah, I've always loved songs, and the different, like, sometimes when we're singing them together in this group, I hear different like phrases and different words pop out at me at different times, you know, and I think, oh, that's such a great line. And there's a great line in Lovely Nancy there, Eamon's going to sing shortly, and just some really nice bits and pieces in the different songs that come out at different times. I don't know why that is here, but yeah, it's good.
It's kind of where you are when you sing the song, I would think. It's like emotionally what pops out.
Yeah. You know? And the combination of our voices, you know, that fascinates me. We spent a long time out in Sligo, where John's from, just kind of getting our harmonies together and trying different ideas. And we weren't going for a kind of conventional, really, approach of how to work out the harmonies. We just tried to experiment and find what worked with our voices.
In Irish music, harmony isn't necessarily part of the tradition at all, so we wanted to try and kind of get that together as well.
So nobody is necessarily singing any particular part. It's just what works on the song.
Exactly, and just wherever our voices fall. I mean, and there are times where we listen back to recordings, like practice recordings, and there were times where I couldn't tell if it was John or if it was myself singing a certain part, you know what I mean? Because we'll sometimes cross, I'll start low, he'll start high, but then at some point in the song we'll cross over, which I'm sure some purists might tell you is not an advisable way to go about singing harmonies, but it just, that's the way it went.
Sometimes it was a fourth voice in there, remember?
That's true. That's true. We were visited by a spirit at one point in our rehearsals in Sligo, where when we listened back to the tape, I'm telling you, there was a fourth voice. There was someone singing a fourth part on the tape, even though there were only three of us in the room, so you can make of that what you will.
Was it a higher or a lower voice?
It was a low.
Oh.
It was a very...
You should put that on the album.
I wonder if he made an appearance. Did he actually make it onto the album?
I don't know if he made it onto the album, but he's certainly not getting paid.
No. Well, let's get into the next song. And this is another traditional Lovely Nancy. And Eamon, where did you first hear this one?
Well, actually, funny you should ask the question like that, because I've never heard the song. It was a song that I found in a book in a great old collection called Sam Henry's Songs of the People. Sam Henry was a journalist in the north of Ireland. He wrote for a paper, and he would collect songs in the community and in surrounding areas. And every week he would publish a song or two in the paper, and they were all collected into this fantastic book. So I would often just leaf through that book. I mean, there are thousands of songs in the book. I would leaf through it and maybe play through the melodies or just read through the verses. And if something caught my eye, I'd explore it a bit further. And this is a song like that. I'd never actually heard anyone sing the song. Just found it in the book, kind of toyed with the melody a little bit, adapted it a small bit. And also sometimes, like, there's a whole process in putting together one of these songs where you'll adapt the verses too, lyrically. Like, you'll just take maybe swipe a verse from another song or whatever it is, you know. So this song I had never actually heard before we kind of started working on our arrangement. There's definitely a lot of kinship with other songs. There's a song called Johnny Lovely Johnny that shares some of the verses with this song. So, that's part of the joy of this process, is putting together a song that maybe you haven't heard before or certainly hasn't been, you hope, overdone at the very least.
And this is the one that leads off the new album that you hope is arriving.
Exactly.
I'm just not exactly sure where in Milwaukee it's arriving. But
it will be here at some point.
We're told it's going to arrive at one of Milwaukee's finer hotels. We're just not sure if it'll be the Hilton or the Hyatt. So.
Well, hopefully it will find its way down to the fest grounds, because that's the important thing.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. I hope so. I really hope so.
All right. Well, here is the Alt in Lake Effect's performance studio with Lovely Nancy.
When first unto this country a stranger I came, I fell in love with a young girl, Nancy was her name. Nancy was a young girl, never was fond of young men's delusions, false and flattering tongues. Going my Nancy to see, she said, tell me the reason that you cannot love me. Because there is a red rose in yon garden fair, and I would love you, Nancy, if she were not there. Never have I courted you, no, never in my life, that you should lay upon me
the cause of any strife. Oh yes, you have courted me, and very well it's known. It was in my father's garden in the county of Tyrone. With my apron round us to keep us from the sun, it's there I told you, Johnny, you had my heart won. The next place we courted was in yon green wood, where the branches hung over the ground whereon we stood. If I ever courted you, it was only in jest. I never intended to make you my best. I never intended to make you my wife. Oh, Nancy, lovely Nancy, all the days of my life. All that I can say, my only hope is that we both will be judged on one day. And on that day of judgment, rewarded you will be for the vows and false promises that you made unto me.
Was Lovely Nancy, the Alt in Lake Effects Performance Studio, lead sung by Eamon O'Leary on that one. And we also have Nuala Kennedy and John Doyle. Great, great song. I love the arrangement.
Thank you very much.
You know, I find it fascinating that the Irish and maybe the Scots song traditions didn't have harmonies. The Welsh did. That part singing. It's so close, and you'd think there would have been some bleed over, but there isn't.
Not that we know of,
yeah.
So far, anyway.
I think it really wasn't in Irish music in the church circuit. There wasn't really harmony singing. It was more like for the individual,
yeah,
one line melodies. So I guess like when you know like a lot of the old songs, the melodies are you know the melodies of the church songs are taken from older songs. So maybe you know change it. But plus we had a different history, kind of a history of oppression of the Catholic Church. So that might have had something to do with it too.
Where that just influenced,
yeah,
what the music was allowed to sound
like.
Because
we didn't have churches as such for ages, and we had hedge schools and things. So you didn't really have a singing tradition as such underneath a hedge.
And Nuala, you live in Edinburgh now, right?
Yeah.
Even though you're from Belfast?
Yeah, my parents are from Belfast, and I grew up in Dundalk, just over the border in the south there. And I moved to Edinburgh many years ago now, so I've spent just about half my life in Scotland and growing up in Ireland, the other half there. So, yeah.
And so looking at the two different song traditions, how similar are they and how different?
Oh, they're pretty similar. Like there's a lot of similarities, more than differences, I would say, between the music and song of Scotland and Ireland. You know, a lot of it originates in similar places. And in fact, in Dundalk, where I'm from, there's old manuscripts there that have Scottish pipe tunes notated in them that you can clearly see are Scottish pipe tunes, and they're written down by, you know, priests in the area hundreds of years ago. And so there was a lot of back and forward between the Western Isles of Scotland and the east coast of Ireland in that area, you know, just a huge amount of back and forward and marriages happening between the two peoples and trade. I feel very at home in Scotland. It's kind of, to me, it's a Celtic land, Celtic nation, like Ireland, and people appreciate the music. And Edinburgh is full of musicians and great tunes. So kind of that's what attracted me to it and what's kept me there so far.
Well, now that you have this group going, what does it mean in terms of rehearsals? Do you have to plan around all of the touring and other things to actually get together? Are you doing this via Skype, or how is this working?
Well, we're all fairly spread out. John and I both live in the United States, and so we're all over the place. So what we did when we were rehearsing for the record is we all met in Sligo, where John was living at the time. And we've met there a couple of different times and rehearsed there. Then we've also met and rehearsed down in North Carolina, where John lives at present. Yeah, just between tours, whenever there's an opening in the calendar, we've gotten together to rehearse for the record, and I assume that'll be the way going forward.
We usually ring the Mystery Fort singer.
Yeah.
He's the hardest
he's
one
our
to
point
pin
man.
Down.
Yeah, right. Is he reliable? Does he always show up?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely
yeah.
not. No.
He thought of the name De Alt, you know. That was his idea. I think he's a Sligo guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the name, because you said that is from Sligo originally.
It is. It's the Alt is an area very close to Knocknarea. If anyone knows Knocknarea, there it's Queen Maeve's burial ground was on the top of it, which is this very ancient cairn that's on the, you know, very scenic, beautiful area. Queen Maeve was meant to be buried there, but standing up with her sword and spear in one hand, facing her enemies. And just underneath it, there's a kind of like an enclave called the Alt. And I always just loved that name.
Well, I want to thank you for taking time out of the teaching schedule to come over and record for us a little bit. And what are you going to sing us out with?
Well, this is a song called One Morning in May. It's the song on the record. I wanted to contribute something that, for me, was associated with Dundalk, where I'm from. And this song was sung by the late, great Ethna Ní Hualachán, who was a wonderful singer and flute player that I knew as a teenager. And I heard her singing this when I was in my late teens, and I never forgot the song. It's such a beautiful melody and just a lovely sentiment in it too. So we put it on the record, and it's another one where normally it's sung unaccompanied, but we've done an alt arrangement of it, and John's singing some harmonies on it, and hope that you like it.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for coming in.
Well, thank you for having us. It was a pleasure.
Thanks.
The Alt is Nuala Kennedy, vocals, flutes, and whistles, John Doyle, vocals and guitar, and Eamon O'Leary, vocals, bouzouki, and guitar. All three songs they sang for us, Going for a Soldier, Lovely Nancy, and this one, One Morning in May, are on our website, wuwm.com/lakeeffect. You can find a link to their performance times at Irish Fest there as well. We'll take one last break, and then we'll talk about Celtic music of a different sort. Baritone Benjamin Luxon and folk singer Bert Biscoe join us next to talk about the music, poetry, and stories of their native Cornwall. That's coming up next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
My young love said to me, my mother won't mind, and my father won't slight you for your lack of kind. And she stepped away from me, and this she did say, will not be long, love, till our wedding day.
Welcome back to Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It is great to have you with us. Before the break, we heard some traditional Irish songs. Our next guests come from Cornwall, the very southwesternmost tip of England, that has its own song, poetry, and story traditions. It's a tradition that's alive and well in Wisconsin because many Cornish people came here to settle in the late 19th century. Before he retired, Benjamin Luxon was one of the preeminent and acclaimed baritones of his generation. He sang everything from opera to pop, music hall to folk. Bert Biscoe is a folk singer of some note and also a member of the city government of Truro East in Cornwall. They're here in Milwaukee to celebrate Cornish culture with a performance tonight at the Zelazo Center on the UWM campus. They stopped by the studio first, and Biscoe began with the story of the revival of the Cornish language.
In the 16th and 17th centuries, Cornish went into decline because it was pushed into decline for various reasons. And by the time you got to the end of the 19th century, Cornish was clinging on by a thin thread. Basically, St. Ives fishermen were gossiping with Breton fishermen out at sea, and that's where it just clung on. It clung on in the place names, it clung on in terminology and grammar in the dialect. And then in 1904, a man called Henry Jenner wrote a new grammar of the Cornish language. He went to the Celtic Congress and made a speech in Cornish, and the Cornish were admitted to the Celtic Congress. And from 1904 until 2004, a campaign of reinvigorating the language, rekindling the language, was taken up, and we've seen various institutions grow and the language has grown. And in 1904, Henry Jenner wrote to the Home Secretary and the government and said, "When are you going to recognise Cornish as a minority language?" And in 2004, the government did. It's been a cultural triumph of the 20th century. All the hassle and all the terrible conflicts and depressions of the 20th century, and the Cornish language has very quietly rekindled and is now... It's alive and it's doing well, but it still needs nurturing. So it's a beautiful thing.
It's gone through various stages because, first of all, it was a kind of bastardized Welsh, really. It was mixed in a little bit of Cornish, but a lot of Welsh mixed in. Mm-hmm. And then as time has gone on, particularly in the last probably 40 years or so, there's a whole lot of original Cornish documents and plays and various things which have come to light in various libraries and things around the country. So we've actually been able to there's been a fight about that. I mean, there have been a number of groups about the different versions of the language. But gradually the language we've been able to get right back to, very nearly the origins of the language.
Yeah. And it had been a written language earlier when
yes, it was written. I mean, the great reservoir of Cornish language is a cycle of medieval miracle plays, which are known as the Ordinalia. And they were written down by monks at Glasney College in Penryn, a monastery which was dissolved by Henry VIII, which was one of the reasons why the Cornish language disappeared, really, or nearly disappeared. And they wrote down these miracle plays. And in recent times, we've seen those miracle plays revived, and there's been an awful lot of scholarly study. So that gave us a reservoir of vocabulary. Other texts, as Ben says, have come to light. Quite a lot of them, actually, in Welsh libraries. Yeah. Interestingly, and then we've Dr. Johnson in the 18th century was the first man to produce an authoritative dictionary of English, and of course, any language which is going to become a language which moves beyond the colloquial has to have a spelling system. And English in the 18th century went through huge ructions in order to get there. And in the latter part of the 20th and early part of the 21st, Cornish has been through a similar ruction. And we now have something which is called the standard written form. What is interesting about the standard written form is in order to come to an agreement between all the groups who were saying different things, we commissioned the five leading social linguists on the planet. And we thought we'd start at the top of the pile and work our way down. And we issued an invitation to the top five, and they all accepted. And it had never occurred to us in beloved little Curno, stuck down there on the end of Britain, that actually what we were doing with our language was regarded around the rest of the world as being of great importance, not just to our language, but to the revival and the sustaining of minority languages all over the world, which is a really important international network.
Can you say hello and give me something so we can hear what Cornish sounds like?
Dithda.
That is?
Good day.
Dithda.
If it was the morning, it would be Mittendar. If it was the afternoon, it would be Dhajithda. If it was the evening, and this is my favorite, it would be Gorthugada.
Oh, I like that.
I do.
That's lovely.
It's like catching a trout.
Moving from the language to the music of Cornwall. Ben, you come from singers. I mean, I've read lots of interviews with you, and you everyone sang from
yes,
the way you
that's
describe.
Right. I think it's a Celtic thing. For a start, I think it's the Celts express themselves through singing, or their, you know, our particular Celts, the Welsh and the Cornish, certainly. I also think it's probably linked to John Wesley. And, you know, he had some of his biggest successes with the Methodist religion, right? He had some of his biggest successes in Wales and in Cornwall, both mining communities. Very different, coal mining in Wales and mineral mining in Cornwall. But they seemed to take his message probably as well as anyone else did. And, of course, the Methodist religion abounds with the most wonderful hymns. They're just stunning. Four-part harmony. In actual fact, I very often thought, I don't know what you think about that, Bert, but I've often thought that the Methodist religion was so strong, had such a strong grip on music in Cornwall, for instance, that the folk tradition is not very rich, in actual fact. The Cornish folk tradition is not very rich.
I think that Methodism is a double-edged sword, really,
yeah.
Because in a way, it was a folk tradition. It used all the tools of a folk tradition to get its message across. But it also took a very, very stern view of folklore. Yes. So to a great extent, if you were going to accept the discipline of Wesley, then it was at the expense of your folklore and your folk traditions. Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons. And I think there's one other thing, particularly about the sung tradition, the ballad tradition, and that is, of course, is that the ballad was the media, you know, like reggae in Jamaica. You know, it was the media. And as the printed word became more easily available and as more people got to read through the 19th century, you saw more education and so on, so the need to communicate through song lessened. So it's a complicated sort of...
It is very complicated, but I do know that the Cornish folk repertoire probably there's a lot more happening now than there has been. If you look in, you know, the recorded volumes of folk song, it's not very... They crib tunes like crazy. They didn't write many original tunes.
I think actually what you've got in Cornwall is a stronger tradition of storytelling or yarning. We call it. And if you look at when the Cornish, when the mining industry started collapsing at the end of the 19th century, and we started to see this great emigration of Cornish people, which is why so many Cornish people are in America, one of the things that they did was, in order to stand out from the crowd, is that they all started sending home and saying, send us dialect stories written down. And there was this massive explosion of publishing of old tales and new tales, some ballads, and some of them were probably sung. The thicker and more incomprehensible the spelling system was in the dialect, the more the miners liked it, because the more different it looked on the coffee table in the cribbet, you know, whatever it was. And this massive explosion took place. And I think that the oral tradition in Cornwall, which is I think, you know, lasted more strongly than any. Is very strong.
So you are here to celebrate Cornwall, to celebrate the Cornish storytelling and the music and the poetry. Yeah. There's quite a bit of people of Cornish ancestry here, and I'm going to bring you up very quickly, Catherine. What are you planning this weekend?
Yes, well, the gathering of the Cornish cousins is a wonderful opportunity for the diaspora, that is, those of us that live around the world and have Cornish heritage, ancestors, getting together here in Milwaukee this week. It's sponsored by the Cornish American Heritage Society and by the Greater Milwaukee Cornish Society. And so we are meeting up on the UWM campus this week and planning opportunities for our music and our poetry and our food to share and tell stories to one another of our own families now.
Well, I was going to say the history of the Cornish people, because most of us here who are not of Cornish extraction wouldn't know. You know, we don't know that that's part of the fabric of this country.
Yes. I think one of the sad things, and that's the Cornish are to blame for that, of course, that they really haven't used the opportunity to delve into their history, to really establish themselves as a nation. And I think they've missed out on so many things, and they've missed out on, you know, these Cornish communities around the world, which are still extremely active and still have the feeling of being Cornish. They're very aware of their Cornish roots. We haven't grasped hold of that to say, listen, here we are. We are a Celtic nation.
So that's part of our purpose this week. We want to let the people of the area know that there are lots of Cornish people in the area. The Cornish that came to Wisconsin, the Cornish farmers settled in the Palmyra area out southwest of Milwaukee in Waukesha County. People that are tracing their Cornish roots through the farming community would be looking around in Palmyra. And then, of course, the miners that came to Wisconsin settled in the southwestern part of the state around the Mineral Point area.
And, of course, we can't let it go by without saying Cornish pasties, because I love them. Love them, love them, love them.
So do we.
Yeah. Are you planning on having some this weekend?
Oh, absolutely.
Here?
Only reason I came. You've got to come to Wisconsin to get a Cornish pasty. All you get in Cornwall is pasties.
I'm hoping before you go, will you say goodbye to us in Cornish? Can you do that? Or give us a little something?
To say goodbye, I would say, Luena Vis. Peace be with you.
Well, I just have to say goodbye because I don't have any Cornish.
Not even to say that.
Well, I could say, I could give you a little tiny song if you want, which is very typical.
I would love it.
All right, this is really typical Cornwall. Well, I'm certain I haven't got nothing. I never had nothing. I don't want nothing except you. I haven't seen nobody. I'm had nobody. I don't want nobody except you. And if you love me, I'll love you. But if you want money, well, I shan't do, because I haven't got nothing. I never had nothing. I don't want nothing except you.
Retired Cornish baritone Benjamin Luxon and folk singer and the independent Cornwall councillor for Truro East, Bert Biscoe, joined us in the studio. They'll perform tonight at the Zelazo Center on the UWM campus. We were also joined by the chair of the planning committee for the gathering of the Cornish cousins, Catherine Herman. That organization is sponsoring the concert, and there is more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And I'm Bonnie North, thanking you again, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.